Thank you all for joining us. My name is Melissa Friedland, and I'm the National Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment at EPA. I'm very glad that you've all tuned in for our webinar. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI as we call it, hosts these webinars as part of a quarterly series about the reuse of Superfund sites. And these webinars share site reuse success stories, but they also challenge with the hope that these stories will inspire you to consider reuse on other blighted properties. Our webinars also provide guidance, tools, and lessons learned to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. And this is the last webinar for fiscal year 2016, but we're already scoping out some great ones for next year. So after I share a bit about EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, we'll be diving into a very packed schedule. We have presenters from all over the country on the line to discuss not only the importance of pollinators, but what we can do to support them. So first in today's webinar, Dr. Larry Zaragoza with EPA will walk us through recent pollinator policies on the national level and what that means to EPA. And following him will be Mary Gallet with Pollinator Partnership, or P2, to discuss why pollinators are critical and to share some lessons learned at their pollinator habitat projects on blighted sites across the country. Our third presenter is Michelle Mahoney. Michelle works with the EPA Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Group at EPA, and she will discuss how ecological revitalization efforts on contaminated sites can protect and support pollinators. Our final two presenters, Catherine Worcester-Brown from EPA Region 7 and Candace Teichert from EPA Region 4, will walk us through how their regions are responding to the call to protect pollinators. And lastly, I'll provide you with a few additional resources and points of contact, and we may have time to take some additional questions. Okay, great. So EPA's primary mission is to protect human health and the environment, and returning contaminated sites to productive use supports these goals. So the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI, works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. EPA's always been supportive of site reuse, but in recent years, reuse has become an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals. And it's important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. The earlier reuse can be considered, the better. And there are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution when deciding which reuse type will be most appropriate. And many sites can support multiple types of reuse. So today's webinar will focus on pollinator habitat, which is often paired with ecological or recreational reuse at sites. And there are many excellent examples of site reuse, so I would encourage you to visit the SRI website to find more in-depth information. And the link to the SRI website is here on the slide and also listed in your resources pod on the right. And in this picture above, you'll see two photos of the Bayou Verdine site within the Calcasieu Estuary in Lake Charles, Louisiana. So bayou dredging and ecological rehabilitation have enabled continued use of the bayou as a habitat and wetland area, and the grass seed mix planted on the cover includes wildflowers to support pollinators. Okay. Great. If you're considering reuse at a site near you, I'd encourage you to visit the Redevelopment Partnerships page of the SRI website. Collaborating with these organizations helps SRI provide appropriate tools and resources to implement a reuse vision of a Superfund site. And many Superfund sites, believe it or not, have advantageous and desirable locations for any number of uses. Site reuse not only benefits site stakeholders, it provides benefits to EPA. And these benefits include the long-term stewardship of the site, the implementation of institutional controls to ensure safe and appropriate land use, maintenance of the site property, and many others. SRI currently has partnerships with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Trust for Public Land, and Pollinator Partnership. And all of these organizations are familiar with Superfund and willing to work with communities to explore reuse opportunities. So we're thrilled to have Mary Gallet from Pollinator Partnership joining us today. So one final note, this webinar has a panel of pollinator experts. Feel free to ask them questions. We will try to answer questions after each section, but we may hold some questions if we think future presenters will address them. We may also have some time left at the end of the presentation for remaining questions. So with that, I'd like to hand things over to Larry Zaragoza, who will be kicking things off by talking about the emphasis and recognition of pollinators on a national level. Larry?
Thank you, Melissa. So I think pollinator health has really become a very important issue. It's really grown in terms of visibility over the last few years with stories about the impacts that we're seeing on different kinds of pollinators. People have probably read about the bats, the monarch butterflies in particular, the honeybees. The honeybees in particular get a huge amount of attention, and it's very interesting on the honeybees because honeybees are not native to the United States, at least not the ones that we worry about. The honeybees that we worry about have been imported into the United States. But the native honeybees, they're also very important because all of these pollinators help plants to reproduce. They're very critical for reproduction for a number of plants, maybe, and then some estimates maybe say a third to two-thirds, depending upon how you cut it. And then you also have a significant impact in terms of productivity because as plants are able to be pollinated, then their productivity also increases. And so that's another factor. So pollinators are really critical for food security. And food security has become an increasingly important issue for the United States and the rest of the world because there's less land and you want to make sure that you can produce the food you need and you want to also produce feed for livestock and also for as an export product. So it's something that we all think about. The other thing that pollinators are really important for is they're a critical part of the environment. And people may not always think about that right away, but when you look at an ecosystem, there's all these different components of the ecosystem, and pollinators are a very important part of the ecosystem, and you really need the pollinators in order to have everything work as they should. And given these facts and given the dramatic declines that we've seen with some of the pollinators, in particular the monarch butterflies and the bees, this has become an issue that has garnered a lot of attention up on Capitol Hill. The Farm Bill, which was passed a couple of years ago, had provisions in it to deal with pollinators. The president also formed a pollinator task force, which basically engaged federal agencies to undertake work to improve the health of pollinators, and that task force is really a call to action. President Obama has made this I think one of his signature activities, and it gets a lot of visibility. EPA co-chairs the president's task force on pollinator health, and so Gina McCarthy is a co-chair along with the Secretary of Agriculture. I know that Stan Meiberg, our deputy administrator, spends a good deal of time dealing with these issues and coordinating on pollinator issues, both with folks within the agency and outside of the agency. And we prepare regular reports for the White House on EPA's activities. EPA's activities in the area of pollinators focus in two areas. One, pesticides, because some pesticides can have a pretty dramatic effect on pollinators, in particular bees and some of the others. And the other is land. And the land issue is not as big because we focus on things like Superfund sites, brownfields, and others, and promote the use of pollinator habitat as a possible reuse. But it is nevertheless one that we think is important, and it contributes to the overall federal goal of returning land to use so that it can be habitat for pollinators, which is very important. And that is one of the main themes of the President's Task Force. The President's Task Force was announced in 2015. And it really was a call to action. And I actually credit Pollinator Partners for being instrumental in helping to move this along. I watched the way that Pollinator Partners has worked with folks on Capitol Hill and with others. They are one of the most constructive organizations that I've seen operate, and they really bring people together to action. I think that's I just had to say that because they really stand out that way. So I wanted to highlight that the President's strategy created the Pollinator Task Force. It had a number of federal commitments in the plan, including increasing the habitat. And as I said, EPA's main focus is looking at pesticides. And in the case of Superfund sites, one of the things we have done as a program is we have advocated that we look at pollinator habitat as a possible reuse. And the other thing that we're doing is we're seeking to capture the number of acres associated with pollinator habitats. So in some cases, like the chemical commodity site in Kansas, which is one that's received a lot of attention and has been a great success story, it may be a relatively small site, but it garners a lot of attention. Some of the other sites that we have out there, which I think have a fair number of acres, we just have not been able to capture the acres yet for them. And so one of the tasks that we have within EPA is to try to capture those acres. And so if you are close to one of those sites, you work with an RPM that is aware of those, I encourage you to work with them so that they can get that information to us as we do track it. One of the things about pollinators is I think there's been an incredible amount of outreach and coordination. There are multiple meetings that take place to promote an awareness and efforts to help pollinators. Probably one of the best ones I can think of is the Pollinator Partners meetings that take place in the fall. Also, the National Wildlife Habitat Council has had a number of meetings to look at pollinators. And one of the things they have done is they put together a series of issue papers, and one of those are white papers. And these papers, certification programs. And their certification programs deal with a couple of different things. One of them is pollinators. So if you're in industry and you have a facility, you can get a certificate for creating an environment that is supportive of pollinators. And I think that's a great thing to do, because then the community can recognize that, and I think that's a very positive message for any industry to have, that they've done taken a step like that. Similarly, when they've undertaken steps to remediate a site, they can. One of the things they would do is have institutional controls, as Melissa was talking about earlier, and one of the other provisions they could have is at least consider putting together habitat that would support pollinators as well. So that's another tool. So I think I see a lot of work going on in a lot of different places. EPA is just one part of it. Other federal agencies play a much bigger part in terms of some of these actions. But I think that the work that we're doing is nevertheless important, and I think we very much enjoy engaging with our partners on these issues. Monarch Venture, that's another group that is just incredible. I'm kind of amazed because I see their work both inside and outside of EPA. There was a project that I was reviewing a couple weeks ago where Scott was going for an eagle project. And he had worked with Monarch Watch in order to get the seeds for his milkweeds that he was planting as part of his pollinator garden. So that's another group that has just been outstanding in their research and reaching out to people. EPA's role in protecting pollinators is highlighted on EPA's website. You'll see a copy of the page there on your slide, and it's a good resource for you to go to for information. And of course, if you have other questions on EPA's work, you should feel free to let us know, and we'll do our best to help you understand whatever EPA might be doing in the area. One of the things I would note is some of the pesticides, particularly the neonicotinoids, have a reputation for being disproportionately impactful on pollinators. most pesticides are both toxic to people and humans. However, the neonicotinoids, they're, I believe it's something like 4,000 more times more toxic for insects than they are for people. And so because of that, their use is great for people because people don't worry about it as much. But when they went through the registration process, people didn't really think that much about the disproportionate impact on the pollinators. They thought about getting rid of the pests, but not the pollinators. And so that's a factor that's being considered right now by our pesticides office, and they're working very hard on it. They have a number of schedules and have had many, many meetings. One of the things that I really enjoy is talking with my coworkers in the regions. There are a number of RPMs out there who have been helping to develop pollinator habitat at various Superfund sites. And there's, I mentioned chemical commodities, there's, and there's just many, many other sites that are out there that are really worth looking at. And like I say, if you're aware of sites and you think it should be highlighted, please let us know. We're trying to highlight them on our website, and we're also trying to count the acres as well so that we can report them as part of what gets reported up to the President's Task Force. So I have my information on the next slide. So if you have questions, if you would like more information or some follow-up, please let us know, and I'd be happy to do what I can to respond.
Thank you, Larry. We actually have a comment and a question for you. Someone has written in that they recently purchased a special vehicle license plate in Virginia, and the logo is Protect the Pollinators, and apparently part of the extra fee goes toward protecting pollinators. Do you know if that's going on in any other states, or have you seen any of those?
Actually, I don't know if it's going on in any other states, but I do know the state of Virginia, particularly the Department of Transportation, has been a close partner with the White House in terms of their work with pollinators. They've been doing a number of different things. For example, they have been planting pollinator gardens at rest stops in Virginia. And there are bills that are in Congress that would create pollinator habitat in roadway medians and in other places that are just easy to create. So there's a lot of activity in that area, and Virginia has been a good partner.
Okay, great. Mary has just told us that Ohio is going to release a monarch license plate that will directly support Pollinator Partnership's Monarch Wings Across Ohio program. So that sounds like a good thing to keep an eye on. And we have a question for you, which is, could you just talk briefly about the President's Task Force? You've given us some information on that. Can you tell us what future strategies or actions that they're considering to further protect pollinators?
Well, actually, it's not just an action. There is a huge action plan that we contribute to. There's pages and pages. I don't remember off the top of my head. It's probably a 15-page document. That might be it must be at least 15 pages. And then there's an EPA contribution to that. And the EPA contribution alone is multiple steps, including a lot of different things they're doing in terms of reviewing pesticides, different pesticides, holding meetings, bringing people together. And the reason the pesticide issue, I think, is so difficult, one reason is because we really do need food. We really need crops for food. And pesticides have been something that historically has helped to increase productivity. And they've actually engineered plants to be more resistant to pesticides. And so the plants are more resistant to pesticides. They can apply it. They're very productive, but you're having an impact on pollinators, which was an unintended side effect of all of this. And so now they're going back and trying to look at how can they strike a better balance. And it involves getting lots of information, looking at what can be done to improve the situation. And it's just not an easy thing to do.
That's great, Larry. Thanks. And Larry will be around to take questions at the end. So why don't we move on now and we'll hear Mary. So Mary, take it away.
Hi, this is Mary Galay with the Pollinator Partnership. I'm the plant ecologist for the organization. I'm going to talk about the role of pollinators, but also more specifically about a couple different Superfund sites where we helped the company who was remediating the site and transforming that into functional pollinator habitat. So briefly, I'll talk about the role of pollinators. I know a lot of people on the line are very familiar with the role of pollinators, so we won't spend a ton of time there. I'll talk briefly about the Pollinator Partnership. Like I said, provide a couple examples of where we work, but all of you should have received my contact information. I'm happy to talk to you about other sites we've worked on, other scenarios. Feel free to email me after the presentation. And also go through a few resources that we offer on our website. So the role of pollinators. It comes down to a lot of economics, a lot of what Larry was getting at, but we depend on pollinators for our crop production. $217 billion worth of global crop production is attributed to pollinators. I'm sure all of you have heard the statistic that one out of every three bites of food is pollinator dependent. And between 60 and 96% of all flowering plants depend on animal pollinators for reproduction. So this means if you're really trying to get the functionality back into an ecosystem, of course you need the plants, and those plants won't establish and stabilize as independent populations for the most part without pollinators. So you could probably, you know, seed an area for soil stabilization with some grass. But, you know, once you move into forbs and woody plants, you're really looking at needing pollinators on site as well. A little bit about the Pollinator Partnership. We work across the country as well as in Canada. Our mission is to promote the health of pollinators critical to our food and ecosystems through conservation, education, and research. And We do work in all areas connected to pollinators. We also run NAPSE, the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign. This NAPSE organization is very much a Big Ten organization. We really try to connect people to pollinators, whether that's through a training class, like you see on the bottom left with the U.S. Forest Service, planting habitat or research plots with the Fish and Wildlife Service in the top left. We also have research stations going with corporate partners such as Tyson's, featured in the middle of the screen. We also do a lot of work with rights-of-way, including utility rights-of-way, whether that's creating habitat or doing research and monitoring to determine whether or not that habitat is working for pollinators. I'll talk more about our resources later, but one guide you might be interested in specifically is our Utility Rights-of-Way Habitat Development Guide for Monarchs. We also have a Corporate Lands Habitat Development Guide for Monarchs. These are regional. We have four in each of these categories, Rights-of-Way and Corporate Lands. The regionality of it comes in some of the technical guidance, but also in planting lists. We really want to provide people with information they need to get habitat going and then what plants to plant. So Armstrong World Industries, this is a site that many of you on the presentation may be familiar with. The Pollinator Partnership helped with this site, transforming it to the Macon Prairie through CFICS consultation, planting design consultation, interpretive sign development, and website development and hosting. And you could see before any habitat was put in, the before picture, there's some grass and a nice little path there. But to provide some of you with some background of this site, if you're not familiar with it, I'll give it to you now. So the Armstrong World Industry Wastewater Treatment Plant Landfill, or Operating Unit 1, is approximately 4.5 acres. It's located at the southeast portion of the 130-acre AWI site in a predominantly commercial and heavy industrial part of Macon, Georgia. AWI has operated an acoustic ceiling tile manufacturing facility at the site since 1948. So the site has been active for quite a while. The general manufacturing process revolved around the formation of fiberboard. In general, a slurry material consisting of perlite, recycled newsprint, dust, mineral wool, cornstarch, and other recycled materials is blended together in a vacuum and press rolled into various sized wet mats. The wet mats are dried in a gas-fired oven, cut to size, and processed in the finishing operations. And historically, the waste material from this manufacturing process included extraneous raw materials, fluff and waste from the fabrication process, excess fibrous materials from the wastewater treatment plant coil filters, and the wastewater treatment plant sludge. This material was deposited in the wastewater treatment plant landfill between 1970 and the late 1980s. So currently, over many years, intensive investigation of the soil, groundwater, surface water, and sediment were performed in concert with the Region 4 of the US EPA and the Georgia Environmental Protection Division. Recently, more than 50 borings were drilled at the wastewater treatment plant landfill, with more than 350 samples collected to characterize the soil. What was found were polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. They were discovered in the soil and sediment of operating Unit 1, that 4.5-acre within the larger 130-acre site. In 2014, a remedy was developed that eliminated exposure to PCBs and migration off the landfill. The approved remedy consisted of replacing the stormwater swale with a box culvert system, capping the landfill, and stabilizing the eastern side of the landfill with a barrier wall. The implementation of this remedy began in August 2015 and was completed very recently in April of 2016. So during this remediation, the landfill cover was removed and regraded, then capped. Along with the eastern side of the landfill, the barrier wall acts as a stabilizer for the slope to prevent erosion. The concrete stormwater box culverts were installed to eliminate the potential of the PCBs to enter the drainage system and be transported offsite. So all of these systems combined with one another help eliminate exposure to a migration of the PCBs off of operating Unit 1. So that's a lot of technical detail, but does provide the background of the site. I think one of the more important questions that we get when people ask us, so this has happened numerous times, you know, I have a site, but it's capped. Can I really do pollinator habitat on it? Yes, of course you can. So you can see here one of the drawings that we helped put together. And let's see if I can get the arrow going. Okay, so you can see that wall, the barrier wall that I was talking about. It's labeled tall grass and milkweed. So using this opportunity of an area that needed stabilization with grass that was on a bit of a slope, but also an ability to plant milkweed for migrating monarchs. So, you know, looked at what we had to work with, saw what would work there, and then recommended regionally appropriate milkweed. At this site, you'll see a trail and a path that moves through the site and then loops around. So as a visitor, you'll come in, you'll see a little bit of the milkweed, but you'll also see more butterfly habitat and hummingbird habitat. As you move through the site, you'll go to bees and then monarch butterfly in the center. The reason why we group the different types of plantings together is so that visitors on the site can understand that different pollinators need different plants. There's a different palette of plants that are needed if you'd like to attract hummingbirds than if you want to attract butterflies or bees. There's, of course, overlap, but if you're targeting specific pollinators, you really need to look at the plants that you're using. All the species that were recommended and used are regionally appropriate to the Macon, Georgian area. The Pollinator Partnership also hosts the Macon Meadow website. So if you visit the site and you know are interested in planting some of the same plants that you saw on the site, you could visit our website. You could get copies of the interpretive signs that you saw on site. And then you could also get a plant list of the plant materials that were used, so you could do that at home. You could also get some history of the site before you visit or afterwards. Chemical Commodities, Inc., so switching gears to a different site, Larry mentioned this one. Chemical Commodities, Inc. was transformed into a pollinator prairie over several years. This is another capped site, so another example of how capped sites can provide pollinator habitat. The Pollinator Partnership provided planting design consultation, plant selection support, interpretive sign development, and website development and hosting. This site was a former chemical recycling facility, but unlike the Armstrong World Industry site, it was actually it is based in a residential neighborhood. You can see a picture of the before. So working with the community surrounding the site, we worked with Boeing and their contractors in engaging the public to come up with a design that would make everybody happy and inspired to come to the site. And you could see in this design, we also grouped the plantings by pollinator type. So we have a bird area, a bee area, a butterfly area, a monarch area, again with the thought that if you came to the site, you might be attracted to one of these kinds of pollinators or another and would like to replicate it at home. So as you move through the site, you'll see your signs, the interpretive signs, read them, get a feel for what's there, and hopefully be inspired to plant for pollinators at home as well. We depended very heavily on the surrounding community to help install the plants. On planting day, we had over 100 volunteers show up to get this garden going. And now master gardeners care for the garden, weed it, and then hold many outreach events there throughout the year. The Pollinator Prairie has also been certified with the Wildlife Habitat Council. And here's an example of one of the interpretive signs. So these signs are different for each station, each pollinator type, giving the public some basic information on the monarch migration or on native bees to the area. And just like the Macon Meadow, we host the website, giving some history of the transformation of the former chemical commodity site into the pollinator prairie. You could see the volunteers planting the area. I believe that was back in 2012. Now it is a fully established pollinator garden. We also provide plant lists for each of the gardens so people could figure out what they want to plant at home and what would work best. And again, as well as the interpretive signs. So some P2 resources. We encourage everybody to join an existing project or start your own. If you're interested in planting pollinator habitat, you don't need to start from scratch. There's many projects out there that need your support, either as a volunteer or in a collaborative way. For example, we have numerous ecoregional efforts where we're installing monarch research stations throughout ecoregions. Those types of programs could always use additional support. And then we, of course, always depend on volunteers for help in getting pollinator gardens and habitats in the ground. P2 can provide technical support, research, and outreach. We can, help with pollinator plant selection, where to plant the plants, what to plant, what's appropriate, and what kinds of pollinators will be attracted to the site. And then oftentimes, folks that install pollinator habitat, they really want to know if what they're doing is having an impact on pollinators. We worked with Boeing on another site called the Santa Susana Field Lab in Southern California, where they asked us to help revise their seed mix so it was more pollinator friendly, and then to evaluate that seed mix over the course of 5 years to determine whether or not planting that seed mix actually impacted the abundance of diversity of pollinators on site. So once you start collecting that data, you can see a trend over numerous years and determine whether or not your actions are making an impact or if you need to go back and maybe do something different. And of course, we provide outreach support. I encourage you strongly to use what's already out there. We have a lot of materials on our website that are free for download, download and use, including those technical manuals. The Pollinator Partnership also supports National Pollinator Week. In 2017, it'll be June 18th through the 24th. We look for proclamations from governors across each and every state, as well as the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of the Interior. If you're ever looking for an idea of a pollinator event, you could go on the Pollinator Week calendar and see what other kinds of pollinator-related events different organizations and institutions have hosted over the years. Or if you want to team up with an organization in your area with their event, you could get a list of pollinator events in the area. And here's the calendar I was talking about. So once you go on our website, you can get this list of events, and you know, no problem in copying. There's a ton of great ideas on there, some ideas that you know I think are really novel and unique. The Pollinator Partnership is also part of the Million Pollinator Garden Challenge. We're seeking folks to register their pollinator habitat or pollinator garden. The goal is to reach a million different pollinator gardens, and the way that we're keeping track of all of these is through our SHARE program. It's very easy. Go on our website, log in your habitat, and your habitat could be, you know, a pollinator garden that maybe you installed at your headquarters or, you know, a small area, or it could be, you know, a 1,000-acre project that you've undertaken over a number of years. If you're interested in working with children, we have the Be Smart School Garden Kit. We have 10 lesson plans already developed with homework and a different activity. So this is all laid out for the teachers already. They don't need to create anything. You can see some of the activities here in the picture. They're tied to the California State Standards, and a number of these have ended up in teacher resources centers. So if you're looking to provide resources for teachers, this might be a good addition. We also have a number of brochures that you could order from our website or print out for free. We really try to provide information for different types of people and meet people where they are. So you could see pollinators, public lands and pollinators, that's for public land managers. The Plight of the Pollinator is an IVM brochure for IVM specialists and professional pesticide applicators. We also have brochures on specific pollinators like bumblebees or monarchs or even honeybees. One of our more popular resources is our planting guides, and I believe the link is available in the related URL section of the webinar. You type in your zip code and you'll get a list of plants that are appropriate to your ecoregion. So a lot of times people ask, you know, what should I plant for pollinators in my area? This is a perfect resource for you. We took the information and data from those existing ecoregional planting guides and put them into an app. The app is free. It's still version 1.0, but it's the same premise. You enter your zip code, and then you can get a list of different plants native to your region. You could sort. Let's see if I could use the arrow again. You could sort based on the type of flower or plant that you'd like to attract. You could sort based on your sun, soil, or the different habits of the plant, meaning, you know, wildflower, tree, et cetera. So you could start really defining a list of plants that would be most suitable for your site. As I mentioned before, we have a series of regional monarch habitat development guides that are free for download on our website. They take a step-by-step approach for land managers of utility rights-of-way or corporate lands on developing monarch habitat. A lot of these principles could be applied to pollinators in general, but it really is aimed to take people from step one of, you know, forming a group of partners to get the project going, all the way through, you know, evaluating the project and seeing what worked and what did not. So those are just a few of our resources and a couple of projects that we've worked on. Again, both Superfund sites, both CAP sites, both extremely challenged, but nonetheless, they still got pollinator habitat going in a very meaningful and, I think, constructive way, engaged the public, and now, you know, people from the public can visit those sites and see pollinators in action. If anybody has any questions, you're welcome to call me or email me after the presentation, questions about those sites or other sites we've worked on as well.
Thank you, Mary. We do have a few questions that have come in, and I'm hoping you can help us out with them. One is, somebody's written in, do industrial sites require ongoing maintenance to maintain them, I guess, once they've become pollinator gardens?
Yeah, I would say every site requires some level of maintenance. You know, it really depends on the type of end habitat you're looking for. For example, the pollinator prairie is very, very public. A lot of people go through there. So their threshold of dealing with weeds is probably a lot lower than a site that's more remote, not highly visible or accessible to the public, but nonetheless you still want habitat on. We have a number of those sites. So the threshold for accepting weeds is a lot higher. You know, nobody's going to go out and hand weed 1,000 acres. But if you've got a garden in the middle of the neighborhood, you certainly, you know, will need more maintenance on that site.
Okay, great. We've got another question. Someone's asked, what's the minimum depth of clean soil that's needed to support healthy plant growth? And do you ever see poor growth due to contaminant uptake?
That's a great question. In the two sites, well, we haven't collected data on the plant growth. The two sites, the plants are doing well and have established. I don't know an exact minimum, but if you'd like to email me, I could do some research on that.
Okay, great. And we have one more, and then I think we should probably move on to the next speaker. But what advice would you give to people who have a lawn service, and the lawn service comes in, and they say, I'm going to help you out with your weeds, and I'm going to give you some fertilizer, and what effect is that likely to have on pollinators, and are there sort of, is there advice that you could give to people who need to have this service, but they don't want to end up doing damage to pollinators?
Yeah, sure. So I guess I would look at, you know, what kind of pesticides are being used on those weeds. Is it, you know, a prophylactic pesticide that's, you know, killing everything in sight, or is it targeted towards those weeds? Oftentimes it's really not a targeted use of pesticides, so that's really where the problem comes in. There's some really good research out there on incorporating, looking historically back and seeing how people used to incorporate clover into their grass seed mix. And that clover actually has been proven to push out dandelions. So if you have a dandelion issue, you know, it would be a project to undertake, but starting to reincorporate clover into the mix will both be pollinator friendly, and, you know, you reduce your use of pesticides and move away from the dandelions. Of course, you won't have, you know, perfect grass. It'll have clover in it, but at least it won't have dandelions. And then there's other, you know, other companies and services out there. In the Cleveland area where I was recently based, they have a number of different green lawn services that do a very good job in eliminating weeds without using pollinator pesticides that are harmful to pollinators.
Okay, that's great. Thank you, Mary. We'll try to deal with them at the end of the webinar. So let's move on now to Michelle Mahoney.
Great. Thanks, Melissa. And I just wanted to say, Mary, that's very interesting what you said about clover and not having dandelions, because my backyard is full of clover and I don't have dandelions. And in my front yard, there's no clover and there's lots of dandelions. So that's an interesting observation I have now. Thank you. As Melissa had said earlier, my name is Michelle Mahoney. I work with EPA. I'm in the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. I'm just going to present to you some of the tools we have available at EPA related to ecological reuse of contaminated sites, so you know where you can go in the future for some resources. Just a little bit of definition and background. Ecological revitalization is basically the process of returning our contaminated lands from a state of being void of vegetation to one that supports a functioning and sustainable habitat. Ecological revitalization is an innovative and cost-effective land reuse that can provide both direct and indirect benefits for pollinators and the community alike. As you've heard, pollinators are protected when ecological revitalization efforts to improve soil health, support native vegetation, contributing to green infrastructure, and promoting overall sustainable land reuse is incorporated into the cleanup. Ecological revitalization has also been shown to translate into dollars and cents for communities. We've seen this by increases in nearby property values, tax revenues, increases in tourism in communities, healthy lifestyles. People have areas to get out and walk around. There's also flood control and stormwater costs can be reduced from incorporating ecological reuse, and then also improvements in local air and water quality. The two pictures that you see on this slide are two different sites. The one on top, if you listen to our webinar in March, our SRI webinar in March, which is archived, you'll recognize that the top photograph is the TVA Kingston site in Kingston, Tennessee. There was a massive fly ash spill, which debilitated the area. The site was cleaned up, and not just cleaned up, but they removed, disposed the contaminated material, and then conducted an extensive ecological restoration using native species and pollinator-friendly plants. So the photo here is of a riparian zone planting that they did. The bottom photo, you've heard a lot about the Landia Chemical Company Superfund site in Lakeland, Florida. I believe we've done a webinar on that one previously. This site supports the soil remedy by minimizing contaminant movement, and it also provides a space for native plants and trees to thrive. There's home to over 1,000 plants here, including 30 varieties of grasses, sagebrush, maple trees, slash pines, and poplar trees. And as the trees mature, they will remove contaminants and reduce the stormwater infiltration from the site. There's also wildflowers, grasses, and shrubs at this site. And this project is also playing a more important, broader role in that it's working to connect areas called ecological or green corridors by providing a habitat for migrating birds and pollinators. And I wanted to present to you the online resource that I mentioned called EcoTools. It's the website is here, www.cluin.org/ecotools. And here we post a lot of information related to ecological reuse, including pollinator protection. There's information regarding principles for ecological land reuse, information on using soil amendments and building soil health, additional resources that we find from other organizations. And like I mentioned, the web link is here. We recently added a section on ecosystem services, which is, provides more information about not only pollination, which is an ecosystem service, but other services such as carbon sequestration, aesthetic values, clean air, improved water quality, and cultural values that can be provided from doing ecological land reuse. So nationally, you heard about how EPA is making intentional efforts to identify opportunities to protect pollinators and their habitat. Next, we're going to hear from two of our EPA regional offices, Region 7, which includes the Midwestern states, and then Region 4, which is our Southeastern states. And these two presenters are going to share some examples of successful pollinator habitat creation and what they're doing in their region to make pollinator protection a priority.
Okay.
And then here's my contact information if you have any questions after the webinar about this topic.
That's great. Michelle, let me just ask you, are there any other webinars on this topic that you know of?
Yes, we've done a number of webinars on ecological reuse. Some of them have been through Superfund redevelopment. Some of them we've done independently. And you'll find them all archived, a link to the archives on cluin.org/ecotools.
Great. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and we'll move to Catherine, who's going to tell us about building pollinator protection into cleanup in Region 7. Catherine?
Yes, great. Thank you. Yes, I'm Catherine. I work at the EPA Region 7 office in Lenexa, Kansas. We serve the states of Kansas, Missouri, Iowa, and Nebraska. And our region has a lot of agricultural influence. And because of that agricultural influence and because of the presidential memorandum on protecting pollinators, our senior management thought it might be a good idea to create a Region 7 pollinator work group. So I thought I might talk with you a little bit about our Region 7 pollinator work group. Maybe there's some people on this webinar who could create a pollinator work group in their own offices. So the senior management asked people from all through our region to come onto this work group. We have people that are ag advisors. We have people in the Office of Public Affairs. We have Superfund and RCRA project managers, pesticide program people. We have a botanist. So all of us got together and decided that our purpose of this work group is to identify regional programmatic opportunities to facilitate pollinator protection and pollinator habitat opportunities here in Region 7, as directed by our regional administrator and that presidential memorandum. So when we got together as a big group, we decided on some things we'd like to work on, and we kind of broke off into subgroups. One of the subgroups was a facilities where they're looking at pollinator habitat right around our own regional office. And then we have an external and an internal subgroup, and I'm going to talk about each of those just a little bit. So this is our office, and this is the back of it, and as you can see, it's just beautiful. I mean, we moved here in 2012. We came from a very urban core office, so we didn't have any land to speak of in Kansas City, Kansas. And now that we're at this office, oh my goodness, we just have so much opportunity for pollinator habitat. We're very excited about that. And let's see, so I'll show you. So this picture on the left, this is just below our parking lot in the front of the office building. And as you can see, there's just hillside and kind of weedy plants where there's a more of a wetland area down at the bottom. So we have all kinds of ideas for pollinator habitat in that area. The picture in the middle is a 3-acre field on our south side. And we have this idea of tall grass prairie and converting it and adding in forbs for pollinators. And then those retention basins on the right, we have many of those in the back of our building. They're just weedy right now. And again, we have lots of ideas for those, you know, planting swamp milkweed and that kind of thing. So that's what the facilities group is working on. And then the external programs, well, they do a lot of things. That's the another subgroup. And I just pulled out a few of the things they do. They do have a public blog where EPA people write in about pollinator topics like beekeeping and native plants and maybe gardening in their own backyards. And it's posted on the public blog, and the public can read it and comment. Then we have speakers come to our regional office. We had Chip Taylor from the Monarch Watch come and talk to us about the plight of the monarchs. We have a grad student coming in to talk to us about prairie pollinators. Anytime we can get somebody to come in and talk to us, we just love it because we want to keep the topic alive. We want to keep the momentum going for protection of pollinators. And then, of course, it's already been talked about the National Pollinator Week. Well, we make sure we have our own little annual event right here in our office. And we have courtyards outside, and it's just beautiful out there. So we had our event out there, and it was just casual, a couple hours over lunchtime. We had ice cream, and we got some local honey to drizzle over that ice cream for everyone to enjoy. We had an EPA beekeeper bring in an empty beehive and go through what it's like to be a beekeeper with all the tools and equipment, and people were fascinated. We had information about building a mason bee house and information about native bees and information about native plants. We gave away some plants. So there's just lots of opportunities when you have a work group. And then the Healthy Schools Program, that's real interesting. EPA actually has a nationwide Healthy Schools Program. And what we do in Region 7 is there's actually a dedicated person to that program. And he chooses a topic from the Healthy Schools Program toolbox, and it's a PowerPoint. And then he goes to our local schools and he talks about things like lead and mercury and asbestos. And we thought, wow, we should put together a PowerPoint on the importance of pollinators. So we did that. We put it together, you know, there's things on there like kids could start their own garden at their own school. They could grow their own plants by seed and plant them in the garden, watch the pollinators come. They can do things in their own backyard. So we created that PowerPoint, and it's now been adopted into the nationwide Healthy Schools program at the EPA. And then the internals program, this is the one that I work on mostly. I'm an ecological risk assessor, so I work a lot with our Superfund and RCRA project managers. So I work with my counterpart on my pollinator work group. He's a botanist. And what we do is we provide training to the Superfund and RCRA project managers on how they can actually create pollinator habitat on their sites. And one of the things we start off with our training is talking about the pollinator problem, and then the national strategy, and then our EPA pollinator protection plan, including that metric of acres of pollinator-friendly habitat at Superfund sites and RCRA sites. And then we let them know this is how you start. Superfund RPMs can start with the record of decision. Just get it documented in that record of decision that they want to create pollinator habitat at this site. And then in the remedial design, remedial action plan, under specifications, we tell them this is where you put in your seed mix, and the performance work statement, that's where your cost estimate goes. And we tell them we can help them with all of that. And for RCRA project managers, it's a little bit different. For some RCRA sites, there's a corrective measure study, and it is there where they would want to include pollinator habitat as an option and a cost estimate. And they would provide that to the project, to the primary responsible party, or the PRP. Some RCRA sites have the first process in place. And we tell them, okay, if you have the first process in place, at the remedy selection process, and what that is kind of an all-day meeting. And the PRP, that primary responsible party, and their contractors get together with EPA project manager. The EPA project manager creates the agenda for that all-day meeting. So we let the EPA project manager know, okay, on that agenda, write down pollinator habitat as a reuse. And then get that to the PRP at least a couple weeks before that all-day meeting. And then the PRP has an opportunity to see that on the agenda, to think about it. And then when he or she comes for the all-day meeting, they can have an intelligent conversation about pollinator habitat at that site as a reuse. And then we continue with providing great detail into how our project managers can actually create pollinator habitat. You know, they're used to putting on the landfill cap, adding some seed, and then mowing it. And, you know, I think we can all understand that that's easy and it's cheap, and that's traditionally what was done. Creating pollinator habitat, as you might imagine, is, you know, it's just a lot. You have to have more expertise. You have to have more thought has to go into it. It's a little more expensive than just pointing down some grass seed. But we explain to them how important that is. And we also talk about other important considerations, like the surrounding land use. If it's agriculture that's surrounding the possible pollinator habitat, then they really have to consider drift from, you know, pesticides and herbicides. And identifying local ecotypes. For example, you're not going to have the same native plant mix in upper Nebraska that you would in southeastern Missouri. And identifying invasive weeds on that site. And I put a couple on here, that's Lespediza and Johnson grass. In our area, those are two very pesky weeds. And they will ruin your pollinator habitat if you don't eradicate those and maintain that as time goes on. So we talk to them about that and how important it is to eradicate those weeds before they plant that pollinator habitat, because they want to be successful. And we talk about when to seed, cover crops, and developing short and long-term maintenance plans, and we let them know we can help them with all of that. And we have. For example, this one RCRA site in Iowa, this was already an established landfill cap, but it's kind of compromised right now, so we let the PRP know that they have to add some more soil and get plants growing on this cap. And by the way, this would be a perfect spot for a pollinator habitat. And the PRP was actually excited about it. And he contacted us, and we worked with him on a seed mix. And we actually connected him with the Tallgrass Prairie Center, which is located in Iowa. And it's an excellent center. They have, you can purchase seed, local seed mix, just for that area from them. So they've connected with them, and they're going to make it happen. They're even going to have trails going through here for the employees to walk around through the pollinator habitat eventually. And then there's the Superfund site in southeast Kansas, and we're working with the project manager on this site. We've already had her document that in the record of decision that she wants to turn this into pollinator habitat. And we helped her with the seed mix, and that's already listed where it's supposed to go. And she's done a cost estimate, which we've helped her with. All we're waiting for this site now is to complete the work. So those are some exciting things that we have going on in Region 7. And if anybody wants any more information about our training program, our work group, don't hesitate to contact me. I love to talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. We have a few questions for you. So one is, a couple of people have noted, well, if you have space, just do it. Just make a pollinator garden. Has that been your experience? Can you do it anywhere?
Yes. Yeah, you can even if you live in an apartment building and all you have is a big pot, you can plant some milkweed in that pot.
Right. That's good. All right. And then when do you think in the Superfund process should we discuss potential pollinator reuse? When is the best time to consider it?
Well, of course, the best time is when the project manager has that record of decision, because everything follows what that record of decision says. So if it says pollinator habitat is a possible reuse at this site, then it's a lot easier to make it happen. It doesn't have to be that way because, some Superfund sites are already completed, the record of decision's already done, but we can still go back and do some things because in a Superfund program, if it's a Superfund site, we have to do 5-year reviews. So every 5 years, we have to review how that site is doing, and that could be an opportunity.
Okay. And how do you factor in the impact on pollinators when you're doing your ecological risk assessment?
Well, yeah, we don't, that gets a little bit complicated. We don't really look at it quite like that yet, where we actually single out pollinators. We can look at insects sort of on a general population basis, but we don't necessarily choose pollinators as a receptor for ecological.
Okay, great. And just one more question. We'll try to take more at the end. Do you have specific partnerships? I know we've talked about a lot of them on the call, but partnerships, either public or private, that you found helpful during your efforts to facilitate pollinator protection?
Well, I have definitely used the pollinator partnership. I've contacted Mary. I've downloaded their information. I mean, that is a great resource. And then in our area, we also have some local resources like that Tallgrass Prairie Center in Iowa, and we have some, there are a lot of resources in our area, and probably there are in every state.
Great. I think in the interest of time, let's move on to Candace, and then we'll try to pick up some questions at the bitter end. So thank you, Catherine. And Candace, you want to go ahead?
Sure. So, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Candace Tigert, and I am a remedial project manager here in the Superfund Division, EPA Region 4, and I'm also the pollinator habitat coordinator. And so in 2015, after the national strategy was released, we began offering training to our Superfund and RCRA site managers and brownfield coordinators. And so the training consisted of just an overview of the national strategy, and the overarching objectives, as well as the importance of pollinators, some examples of different pollinators, offering resources, and then also opportunities to create pollinator habitat. And so for Superfund specifically, we created a fact sheet for our site managers as well as PRPs and contractors that includes information about what are pollinators and why they're important, different opportunities to create pollinator habitat, as well as a couple of examples, including the Davis Timber Company site in Region 4, as well as the Chemical Commodity site in Region 7, and then native plant resources on the second page, separated by state. And so on the next slide, here are three different helpful resources, and I'm going to go through one of them, which is the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center. It's the Native Plant Information Network and the Native Plants Database. And so when you click on the link below, this page will open up, and so you can do a simple search by a scientific or common name or a family name. But as you scroll down a little bit further, you can do a combination search. And this is really important because you can tailor your plants to your site-specific needs. And so you have everything from light requirements and soil moisture to bloom characteristics. So you can actually select a bloom time and bloom color, as well as size characteristics. And so for a landfill cap, the size characteristic may be important to you. So if you're having to inspect a landfill cap, you can select plants that are of lower height so you can conduct those inspections. And so for this exercise, I selected switchgrass. And there's a specific reason why I selected switchgrass that I'll talk about in the next couple of slides. And so I just simply typed in the common name, and three results are generated. And so I selected the top result. And as you can see here, there's just some basic information about switchgrass and the grass family, as well as the native status. But as you scroll further down, you'll see some additional information, including some images of the grass itself, as well as plant characteristics and bloom information. So in the bloom information section, you'll see the bloom color, time, and then the bloom nodes. And so as you see here, this is a wind-pollinated plant. So you may initially think that this is not necessarily a pollinator-friendly plant. However, if you continue scrolling down further, you will see the benefits section. And so switchgrass is actually a larval host, and the grass family is an essential larval host for most banded skippers. And so you'll see a butterflies and moths of North America. And so it's extremely important whenever you're looking at establishing pollinator habitat on your site that you work with someone like Mary or a plant ecologist to identify different plants that you may not think would benefit pollinators but do in fact benefit pollinators. And so as Larry mentioned, there is an objective and a metric in the national strategy specific to Superfund to track the number of acres of pollinator-friendly habitat at Superfund remedial sites. And so here at EPA Region 4, our approach has been to identify pollinator habitat at existing sites. So there's a lot of work that we've already done on sites that has pollinator habitat on it. And so identifying that pollinator habitat and then tracking that acreage is important. And then, of course, looking at new opportunities to create pollinator habitat. So as Catherine discussed during the record of decision, remedial design and remedial action, as well as during the five-year review. And so once we've identified some of our sites with pollinator-friendly habitat, we'd like to highlight our efforts. And so we're doing that by producing case studies and fact sheets. So we have fact sheets on all of the sites that you see below. And of course, the acreage is noted out to the side. And so this first case study is existing pollinator habitat, and it's at the Copper Basin Mining District site. This is a really large mining site. It's in southeast Tennessee and northern Georgia. They began mining in the 1880s to the 1980s and left over 30 square miles of land barren of vegetation. The photograph that you see was taken in 1912, and so you can see that it's completely barren. Revegetation began in 2002 in certain areas, particularly the North Potato Creek watershed, as well as the Davis Mill Creek watershed, with native species. So they've planted over 400,000 trees, and they included seed mixes with over 20 varieties of native plants and wildflowers. The photograph to your right was taken in 2015. As you can see here below in the grasses section, switchgrass is listed, as well as the flowers, trees, and shrubs. And here is the fact sheet that was created. So it shows the site background and cleanup, reviving a barren landscape, restoring native plants, wildflowers, and trees, and then also providing pollinator habitat and supporting pollinator health. And the point of contact is Lofton Carr. He's the remedial project manager for that site. The next case study is newly created pollinator habitat. So this site is the Agrochemical Company site located in Pensacola, Florida. It was an agrochemical production site. They produced between 1889 to 1975. Contamination of groundwater, sludge, and soil resulted, and the site was listed in 1989. Cleanup included soil removal, solidification, stabilization, and capping. And in early 2015, the PRP actually approached EPA, the EPA RPM, and began researching ecological reuse options and discovered that several conditions made the site an ideal location for butterfly habitat. In particular, the fact that monarchs actually migrate every year through Pensacola. And so a total of 12 acres was identified and planted with a focus on establishing a food source way station for monarchs. So more than 1,700 plants were planted there. And this photograph is actually monarch larvae that was identified on site and photographed in late 2015. And the next slide is the fact sheet that was produced. One of the other great things about this story is that the plants were actually purchased from a nursery that employs approximately 40 adults with developmental disabilities. And so that's another great part of that story. And so additional activities and outreach. So for the past 2 years, we've celebrated National Pollinator Week and National Honeybee Day. We also provided information at the National Association of Remedial Project Managers meeting in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, as well as the Georgia Environmental Conference in Jekyll Island. And then we will also be presenting case study information at the Wildlife Habitat Council's Conservation Conference in Baltimore, Maryland in early November. Youth activities and outreach. So our efforts to educate future generations, because it's extremely important. We participated in the North Birmingham Summer Camp, where we did hands-on activities, participated in hands-on activities with approximately 500 children between the ages of 5 and 12. We also participated in the International Environmental Youth Symposium, and then we have plans to participate in a Science Saturday event hosted by Georgia Pacific, where we'll also do hands-on activities with children as well. And so with that, that concludes my presentation. I thank you for your time. If you have any questions, please feel free to contact me.
Thank you, Candace. We have a few questions coming in, but as we're going to ask you the questions, Mike, can I ask you to put up the survey on the screen so that people can start to take that, because I'm worried about running out of time, and I really want to encourage you all to do this survey because it's extremely helpful to us in planning what the next webinars that we want to do. So, Candace, I guess one question that sort of we've been hearing about a lot is everybody knows somebody who's been stung by a bee and, you know, ends up going into anaphylactic shock and all that. So have you, in the work you've been doing, I guess, first of all, have you gotten pushback from people saying, no, that's a terrible idea, people are allergic to bees? And second, how would you get around that opposition?
Well, so the majority of bees actually do not sting. So it's only a very small percentage that actually do. And so the Pollinator Partnership actually has a great brochure on inviting bees to your site. And it's, I think, and Mary may be able to correct me, I think it's No Fear of Stings is the title of the brochure. And so there's some great information in there about bees. And but in particular, we haven't necessarily received any pushback related to bee allergies or, I guess, concern about that. But I understand that that could be a concern.
Okay. Mary, do you want to add anything to that?
No, not at all. That was spot on.
Okay. And we do have a question, actually, for everybody, which is that they've sort of thrown out to the group, and that is that does anybody know about compensation funds from the natural resources natural resources damages compensation settlements? Have any of those been used to establish pollinator habitats? Does anybody have any experience with that?
No.
No. Okay. Well, maybe we can look into it further. Anybody? Okay. All right. So why don't we go ahead and everybody, I encourage you to do the survey. And I would also encourage you to check. Maybe you can do that. Put that up. Great. Okay. We're just going to give you one more slide for more information so that if you have questions, we'd love to hear from you. Here we go. Okay. We do have a Superfund redevelopment coordinator in every region, and I would encourage you to get in touch with them and also with our speakers today who have all made themselves available. Okay. And we're really close to the end of our session. Yes. Thank you, Kathleen. Natural resource NRDAR funds have been used to create and protect pollinator and avian habitats. That's great. And Kathleen, if people wanted to follow up with you, I think we could tell them you're in region 3. That's great. Okay. And then I have another, while you guys are filling out the survey, somebody's written in to say, is there any effort to create or increase communication with health departments about spraying for mosquitoes? Great question. Catherine or Mary or Candace?
Yeah, I guess if somebody was just asking that and hearing about the spray, I believe, in South Carolina for Zika that ended up killing millions of bees. My executive director did speak with a number of folks in D.C., and it turns out none of that spraying was not under the CDC's guidelines for controlling Zika. So I guess that just really underscores that, you know, it's really important to follow the established guidelines so that incidences like that don't occur.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And anybody else want to contribute to that? Okay, great. I'm going to turn it back to Mike now for some wrap-up. I want to thank all our panelists, and I want to thank all the people who submitted questions, and I hope you'll join us on our next webinar, which we will post on CLUIN fairly shortly. It's been great to have this discussion, and I'm excited about all the work that's going on out there, and I'm ready to go do a pollinator garden myself. All right. Mike, let me turn it back to you for some closing.
Yes, thanks, guys. That was an interesting presentation. I'd just like to remind the participants This was a part of a series of webinars, and you can go to Clue In using the link that's on the screen right now to find more out about those. In addition, we have several or many of the resources that were talked about today available both on the webinar homepage through the links, as well as the related URLs that are in the pod on Adobe Connect. And we also ask that people fill out the feedback form, which was not the survey that we had on the screen, but it's an actual feedback form that's on the Clue In website. And under related URLs, you can see there is a link called Seminar Feedback. And you, additionally, you can also get to the feedback form from the webinar homepage. We appreciate your feedback. And thank you for your participation in today's seminar. Enjoy your afternoon, everybody.